So this is the third side of the May 30th, 2006 session, which is the sixth session, third side. Okay, so I was explaining, so Dean Rask is complaining about the lack of contributions and generosity of the Canadian government in contributing to NATO. And McLuhan explains to Dean Rask that Canada is a borderline case, meaning it has multi-borders. It borders on French, Quebec, French-Canadian. It borders on the what's now called the First Nations, which would be the, in the old terms, Indians and Eskimos. It borders on the Soviet Union or Russia. It borders on the United States. And there may be some others I'm forgetting. So you got English Canada, French Canada, Indian Canada, Eskimo Canada. Then you have the Americans, and you have Alaska, multi-border lines. And so it was very close to the Soviet Union, so it couldn't, Canada could not be engaged in a hot posture in relation to the Soviet Union. It was its neighbor. It was a neighbor to both the East and the West. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So in this complex situation, McLuhan said you have a country whose foreign policy image must be one that looks like a borderline case to the Americans. Borderline being a joke on the idea of being nuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he laid out this explanation to Dean Rask and Claude Bissell, the president of the University of Toronto, who was a member of the Bilderbergers and invited his old friend McLuhan to the Bilderbergers. He was telling me that it was me and Nelson had a meeting with him, and he was telling us about this. He was there watching this happen, and he said, you know, Dean Rask didn't have a clue what McLuhan was talking about, and of course, Dean Rask is supposed to be an authority, and if you say something that he can't understand, he's going to be insulted or take offense, and he didn't like to be confused, as McLuhan was doing to him. So that was Dean Rask. The next incident Claude Bissell told us happened is that they were on a plane flying back to North America, and McLuhan saunters up the aisle, and he sees George Ball writing something. Now, George Ball was, I don't know if he had a ministerial position, but he was the guy designing Nixon, who had just become president 6 months before. He was, and this was in May 69. George Ball is writing the policy for Vietnam that Nixon's going to adopt. He's doing it on the plane, and he's doing it after he's talked to the Bilderbergers, right?
Mm-hmm.
They gave him the broad outlines, you could say. So McLuhan comes up to him and says, I don't know if he asked him what he was doing or not, but he eventually gets to saying, you know, the problem with the Americans is they don't know what the Vietnam War means. And Ball probably said, well, what is the meaning, Mr. McLuhan? And McLuhan said, it's Custer's last stand. Mm. You know Custer, General Custer,
yeah.
Last of the Indians?
Right.
So he's telling Ball that this is Custer's last stand.
Mm.
It's a pretty aggressive statement,
yeah.
If you take in what he's saying. He's saying, you got problems bigger than you realize. You are doomed, is what McLuhan told George Ball.
Custer was massacred, and all of his men were massacred.
Right. So he's saying, you are in a situation where Americans will be massacred. So those were three examples of what he did. Now, if you read the letters, the one he writes to Prince Bernhard when he gets back, he begins by saying, I know I was a bad boy, and I apologize. And then he goes on to say, I've never seen so many stupid people in one room. And I, as a North American, thought that Europeans were more cultured. And I expected more, but I did not get it. These people had no clue about the 20th century. Read the letter.
Yeah. Now, do you see that as being...
And he wrote this to Prince Bernhard, and Prince Bernhard wrote back, I assume you don't mean me when you're criticizing all the Bilderbergers.
Uh-huh.
And McLuhan didn't answer him. Because...
Uh-huh.
He did meet him.
Yeah.
Hmm. And it was right after that that Jonathan Miller got the assignment to do the hit job on McLuhan.
Hmm. Wow. Well, so do you think that...
This is not nonsense. I mean, Liz Jeffrey, a McLuhan scholar in Toronto, wrote her Ph.D. on the suppression of McLuhan in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Well, did McLuhan hurt his own agenda by offending them and thus getting wiped out? Or,
No, because he said these people are irrelevant.
Yeah, he realized he couldn't communicate to them anyway, so it didn't matter.
Well, he knew that the Tetra managers weren't going to succeed.
Hmm.
And that's when you get to the pentatic phase, which is my part of the chart, my quadrant, where the Tetra managers eventually realized this, that it was not in any human chemical body's range of manageable responsibility.
When did the Tetra managers become obsolete?
In 69, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And this overlaps with Dave Worster in the Cosmic Awareness Holy Office, where Rai, the original managing principle all through history, returned to the plane of essence in 1967.
Yeah.
And Worster said that, as a result, the grand design by the Tetra managers was off balance from that point. And it started to manifest in 68 when they started to have problems with the gold standard. And then in 71 when Nixon took the chucked the gold standard and created an international economy based on a floating exchange rate.
Mm-hmm.
That was the end of Tetra management.
Mm.
In economic terms, there were lots of other factors.
Right. Because last week you said you made a statement to the effect that John McCloy, the kingpin of Time magazine, was the last Tetra manager. And when he died, it was the end of the global theater, and that would push it up to towards the late 80s.
Yeah. No, John McCloy acted out the last Tetret manager.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not Time magazine. I mean, I don't know what you were trying to say.
Life. Wasn't he Life? Oh, no.
Henry Luce.
Oh, sorry. I got him confused with Luce.
John McCloy was a industrial Wall Street Pentagon manager.
Right, okay.
And advisor to all the presidents.
Yeah, I think we went into that a little bit, and I got him confused.
Yeah, his book, The Chairman, is, if you read that book, you see the demise of the Tetra manager within normal scholarly terms.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who wrote that book, he just won a Pulitzer Prize this year writing a book on Robert Oppenheimer.
Oh, wow.
His name is Kai Bird. I couldn't remember the last name. I don't know if I had it right last week, but it's B-I-R-D, Kai Bird. But that, to the American expression of the death of Rai, is spelled out in Chairman, the book called The Chairman.
Oh. Huh.
About John McCloy. And look what happened to Mao Zedong. His revolution was dead in the 70s. And nobody was managing the world properly in any national level anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the anarchy of the 70s and 80s, and the anarchy of AIDS being leashed onto the population.
Yeah.
So you want to go through the page.
Yeah.
Continuing the next page.
Yeah.
So read the quote at the top of page 9. We've done the Big Brother. Now we're moving a bit away from that.
Right. And this is from Culture is Our Business.
Yeah, page 104.
Yeah. Probably less obscure than Take Today, but probably almost as obscure.
Yeah.
This is his important stuff. People think they know McLuhan, but they don't know McLuhan unless they've read these things.
Just like they don't know LaRouche.
Yeah.
And they don't know Thompson. They don't know Croker. That this book is a Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
And the Culture is Our Business is McLuhan updating the Mechanical Bride. He's redoing the ads of the Mechanical Bride for the electric age, for the disposable jujube. And I wanted to say that McLuhan described Mechanical Bride to his mother when it came out as a new kind of science fiction where the ads and the comics were the characters. There's no people in the book. Everybody's disappeared. The Matrix reality has begun.
Yeah.
And the characters are the ads and the comics.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense to me to say that in the past, whereas the characters in the book were the subject or the figure, and the ads and the comics were the ground. It just flipped over. You can't say the subject disappeared. The characters disappeared. You can say that they flipped and they became sort of the
hidden ground.
The background. Not even the hidden ground. They just sort of became background to the foreground of the ads and the cartoon.
I'll prove it to you that McLuhan meant the ground. First of all, yes, the ads and comics become the figures because they're your pictorial hieroglyphs that your Michael guy was trying to talk about as a subconscious language before we started the tape.
Right, Michael Pissarian.
Yeah, he doesn't know that what he was laying out about the pictogram in the cells or whatever it was is deeper. What was it? The
symbolic archetype embroidered in metaphysical ancient metaphysical teachings.
Right. Now, here's a guy who doesn't know McLuhan, and McLuhan is showing how ads and comics satirize the symbology from ancient ritual.
Yeah. See, now, from Michael's point of view, he thinks that they were using this ancient symbology as a way because these are part of our racial and collective unconscious minds, they could use it to manipulate the audience in diabolical ways. Because once upon a time, these symbols were used in rituals that had to do with creating an ecology within the subconscious and unconscious of human beings that gave them a kind of a relationship to the metaphysical dimensions. Whereas now he's saying, well, they're taking these powerful images and symbols, and they're just using them they're prostrating these symbols and using them as a way of selling products. In the meantime, they're creating havoc within the subconscious and unconscious ecology of the chemical body, because they're not being used ritually for spiritual purposes. They're being reused in a bastardized way for commercial purposes. And he thinks that then leads to mass confusion and despair in the psyche of young people who are imbibing all this imagery that they can't. It's part of their collective racial unconscious, but they can't even process it, and it's just, and it leads to the dumbing down and the apathy of human beings.
Okay, so I would say that was the condition in the first half of the 20th century and back into the 19th century. Now, by 1950, the Mechanical Bride ads and comics become pleasantly enjoyed by the people. They enjoy their exploitation because the hidden ground is the human. And to show you how it's a hidden ground is that McLuhan says that Wyndham Lewis, who was the first to write a Mechanical Bride type book, in his book in the early 30s on the child cult. Forget the name of the book, but he analyzes ads in that landscape. In The Doom of Youth, the book is called. The Doom of Youth, he's doing that already in the late 20s and early 30s. And McLuhan modeled the Mechanical Bride on the early attempts of Lewis, and then he improved on them. But Lewis is trying to show the human shape in this vast technological landscape, which he has been ordered on Machiavellian lines. That is what you were just trying to describe, a vast technological landscape exploited for devilish purposes. His phrase is ordered on Machiavellian lines. But there's a human shape or a hidden ground, human scale that's surfacing there because the media is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually becoming interactive and tactile. So the hidden ground is that the media is going to prop up the human form. Now, the kids today, some are apathetic, some are energized. You can't really say one or the other. I say the kids are quadriphenic. They're going through all the phases, panic, hysteria, schizophrenia, paranoia, and ecstasy. They flip around with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a fat situation, right, PHAT.
Mm-hmm.
They put on these moods as a phatic operation. The kids are, if you read journalistic columns, they say the young kids today are technologically optimistic. They don't have the reservations about technology that the boomer generation did when the boomers were young. They embrace technology. They feel it's friendly, user-friendly, and that is exactly the seduction the Android meme is doing. It is user-friendly, and it's interactive, and so they don't have the same worries. They have other kinds of worries, but not the worries of apathy and that. There are kids that move into that and kill themselves. They say there's a lot of suicide. But for them,
I got to insert this little story with respect to this idea of kids or suicides. Michael Tesarian, on the show that I heard, he cites an incident, a young guy who was kind of reclusive, stayed home a lot, watched a lot of, his life sort of evolved around media. I guess he didn't have a lot of friends. Goes out to the YMCA to go swimming, falls in the pool, and drowns. But the lifeguard pulls him out and revives him. In the intermedium state where the kid is not yet conscious, but he's trying to regain conscious, and his subconscious is just words are coming out of his mouth, he was repeating verbatim, word for word, television commercials and advertisements that were running around in his subconscious mind. Now, what does that tell you about the programming of the symbolic program, the media using archetypal symbols to program the subconscious minds of people?
The kid was not programmed. It proves my point. He had a TV body, and the TV body was talking.
Yeah. Well, that's a pretty powerful example of your point. Yeah,
yeah,
no, I'm saying, yeah, taken from your point, that's a pretty powerful example of the fact that we really do have a TV body. Because
right.
The TV body, he was like channeling the TV body while he was in the semi-conscious, you know, trying to come back to conscious awareness.
Yeah, it's like he was possessed, you know.
Possessed,
like,
yeah.
But these bodies are new possessions of us. So, you see, the language of Michael about, you know, about a tyrannical imposition of logocentric imagery in the kid's brain is irrelevant. It's the kid's identity was very involved with the TV body.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And did the kid die, did you say?
No, he didn't die.
Oh. But in the recovery...
While he was being revived, he was in the semi-conscious state before he attained full consciousness. His subconscious was just iterating word for word television advertisements.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, on a astral body level, since the prayer, it was a form of prayer coming out, it was the TV body encouraging the chemical body to recover. Right?
Well, okay.
It was praying, and it was translated through the chemical body mouth as TV imagery was coming out, and that was expressing the massage by the TV body inside the kid's chemical body, and that was prompting the chemical body to retrieve consciousness.
I can hear it that way, but as I've heard you say before, nobody's ever said that before.
That's right. Can you imagine me on George saying this stuff? You wouldn't have a clue, and it probably wouldn't be worth my time to try to explain it to him. Because you got to do a little work with Bob.
Uh-huh.
You gotta prepare yourself to understand him. You got to catch up.
Yeah.
You got to dump your worldly concerns and your worldly software interests. You got to take time and study my book and get a bit of a whiff of the best of our time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if anybody ever listens to this tape, you heard it here first.
That's right. So let's see if the Cultures Our Business quote that you're going to read on page 9 in the McLuhan Quadrant relates to this.
Does that start with overkill? I forgot where we're at.
Yeah, surely.
The word surely, okay, yeah. Surely it's not unbelievable that decision makers are totally out of touch with the world they live in. How could any contemporary person in any age be entrusted with powers carefully developed and monopolized by people from the previous time?
Yeah, now that can be applied to, that's McLuhan thinking about the Bilderbergers. They manage older environments. And to manage those environments, you have to be conditioned to the rules of those old environments.
Right.
And so they would not be relevant to the newer environments, which more and more allow the people to run themselves.
Yeah. And I believe that just like people have this, and animals have this instinct for survival to preserve, you know, their life as they know it, I think social institutions and organizations and entities such as the ones that the Bilderbergers were governing, it has, like any ego, it has its own perception of itself and its own need to perpetuate itself. It's a survival need. So of course they would try to conserve and maintain what they have. They can't imagine it all falling apart, and that would be a nightmare for them because they don't understand that there's something newer coming along that they could jump into, or you know, a new model that they could be flexible enough to jump into a new situation and manage it from there.
Yeah, well, they're preserving. It's like the trees. The climate changes, and the trees that grow in a warmer climate have to deal with a colder environment. They do their damnedest to survive, and maybe there'll be a new kind of tree that will adapt to the colder environment. The tree meme would continue. We have to look at the industrial Gutenberg meme. the private identity, because John McCloy was going around preserving the right for you to be Scott Norris and not anybody else, the alphabetic private literate identity, right?
Right.
Chinese didn't have that identity. So Mao was preserving the collective non-alphabetic, but he couldn't stop the larger forces where the Chinese would be affected by the new tactile mishmash, and therefore they would put on private identity as an alternative. So they went west.
Mm-hmm.
They embraced Nixon and the Kissinger Doctrine, and Zhao Ping, whatever his name is, took over from Mao and made China simulate the Western business environment.
And Nixon got all the glory for being the great negotiator, but he was just the servo mechanism for what had to happen.
Yes, the West would go east, or the East would go west. Look at the Gutenberg kinetic environment that McCloy and the Bilderbergers represent as a meme, as a part of nature that will survive.
Mm-hmm.
That must be managed. So it's not just an ego thing. They're preserving part of the legacy of evolutionary phases in the development of technological environments.
Mm-hmm.
They're a Noah's Ark for that phase. And though people may not believe that their private identity is being preserved by the tetra managers of the Bilderberg level, that is a fact if you look and understand what McLuhan is presenting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so McLuhan says, surely it is not unbelievable that decision makers are totally out of touch with the world they live in. How could any contemporary person in any age be entrusted with powers carefully developed and monopolized by people from the previous time? So he's trying to explain to his audience why Nixon and them look so fragile and out of sync.
Yeah.
And he's also being satirical because he's saying they're the decision makers. They're decision makers within certain, like Bush, I make the decision. That's within certain industrial environments, but it isn't, by the 60s, the only environment that's involved in the mix. So other people manage those environments. You got Oprah. She manages a huge TV part of the TV body, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Good Morning America shows and all the other shows that people have as staples in the TV body. But the chip body kids, they're involved in MySpace and all the things that have happened on the web over the last 10 years. That's where their sense of vitality and identity is achieved. And it's a different kind of identity than the identity that John McCloy was preserving.
Yeah.
But as those chip body kids get older and are forced to have a private identity and want to have a family, get a job, and then compete, they move toward the old kinetic industrial profile.
Mm-hmm.
And then they move up the corporate ladder, they say.
Mm-hmm.
And they hope they believe there's some position of a fulcrum of power there, but there isn't. And that ends up causing a crisis for the yuppie.
Yeah.
Because that world is only an image, a meme. It's not actually implementable. And we've seen...
Well, it's like getting involved in a basketball game. There's competition, and there's a paycheck at the end of the rainbow if you know how to compete in that environment and play that game and you're good at it. And so it's a, you know, it's you're being involved in a game, and the game has stakes, you know, like, do I get to have this, you know, $500,000 house or not, you know, to raise my family of four kids or whatever.
And then when you get to that level, you can buy all the new digital gadgets, and you will not be able to make the kids the way you want them, because
yeah,
they'll be made immediately user-friendly, autonomous, and also discarnate, and all kinds of aberrations will happen in your children,
yeah,
because they'll have more than one body, and you don't know, you have to manage all four bodies.
So you never get to have the family that you imagined you were going to...
That's right.
...that you were buying.
Yeah, half the families in the world, in North America or in the United States, are single-parent families now.
Yeah.
Nixon and LBJ thought they were preserving family values or that family thing. They didn't know the environment would wipe away the family way beyond, you know, what they thought could happen.
Yeah.
The neoconservative family values are trying to preserve the family, and they're all dealing with a situation where the family has disappeared,
mm-hmm,
at least the chemical body family.
Yeah.
The kids are involved in another kind of family, the family of rock shows and hip-hop and TV body content. That's their family.
Yeah, and they're picking up really bad dietary habits, both the food and media.
Yeah, for the chemical body.
Yeah, for the chemical body.
If the chemical body is the ghetto.
Yeah.
See, that's why rap is popular, because it's offering, you know, anthropomorphic chemical body rhythms, and it's in the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that it's a black ghetto. But they're the closest cultural relationship to the chemical body ghetto.
Yeah.
The meaning is the chemical body is a ghettoized in dancing. And so the traditional idea is the blacks in North America grew up in the ghetto. They're the closest and resonant image to the chemical body's ghetto. And that's why, you know, other cultures don't look on rap as a black thing. They see it as part of their culture.
Yeah.
Biggest market for rap is the white suburban kids. So
we had gangsters back in Chicago in the 20s and 30s, and these guys are retrieving the gangster.
Well, that's just one genre of rap. It's just a general idea of the black culture.
Yeah.
Coming out of a poor situation and realizing the chemical body's American dream, and then the frustrations of it. And that is expressing the white chemical body and Japanese chemical body and all the other cultures that are into rap as a global phenomenon. It's really expressing the ghettoizing of the chemical body.
Right.
And that includes bad nutrition.
Yeah.
So what were we, how did we get on that? There was something else we were taught you. Why did we get on to that? The chemical body, the music?
I don't know. It might have been
family.
Family.
Family, the Nixon. Don't know why I went over there, but, the kids, so you move up and you get the meme, the Bilderberger, and this is where conspiracy is rampant as a game. Oh, yeah, it was the game thing I wanted to mention. Did I send out to you guys, post-Sputnik environment equals media, equals art forms, equals games, equals sport under wraps? Did you see that equation? Did I just post that on the McLuhan list or send it out to you?
I haven't seen all my email, but I haven't seen that.
Yeah, well, the point is you're talking about it's all a game. Now, the media environments do not exist in this seamless web, but they are there for memes to be played with. And so the only other chapter that has the definition, the extensions of man, is the games chapter, chapter 24 of Understanding Media. So the book is called Media, Extensions of Man. But you're understanding what media are. They are games, because chapter 24 says games are extensions of man, right? The only other time you use that phrase. Matched with that phrase. So media are games, which then becomes sport, which then becomes war. Sport is war under wraps, or a new kind of sport. So I'm giving you the quote, the equation that supplements how you're saying that interacting with different old separate media environments is just a game, propping up a meme.
Yeah, and a game with stakes. Again, if you have a family of four to feed, you have to have income, and the game is, you know, am I good at what I do? And like I say, there's competition involved and money, and so something's at stake.
Yeah, the chemical body. But
yeah.
One doesn't realize it's only one quarter of what's at stake.
Right.
Where you always lose the game.
Yeah, yeah.
So we move on to the next quote, page 46 in the book from Cliché to Archetype, which came out in 1970, and the previous quote was from Cultures Are Business, which came out in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Want to read this one, Overkill?
Overkill, the technologies for total destruction of mankind and the planet, create a peace, end quote, that passes all technology. I don't know if the way I read that makes any sense.
Overkill. The technologies for total destruction of mankind and the planet, create a peace or flip into peace that passes all technology.
Mm-hmm. And that's Bernard Mandeville. Oh, Bernard Mandeville built his Fable of the Bees on the same observation, private vices, public benefit. Quote, private vices, public benefits, unquote.
Yeah, Mandeville wrote 1700s. And he was celebrating the beginning of the Gutenberg galaxy, moving into the kinetic culture, where every man warred against every other man to survive. Darwinian social survival.
Uh-huh.
And this led to all kinds of private corruption and exploitation. But there were services that came out of that. So private vices led to public benefits. The conspiratorial way of running governments and city halls and towns and villages and management and business in the 1700s and 1800s had flipped into environments that became public benefits. So Mandeville laid this out in his book, Fable of the Bees. So, private vices, public benefits. So, McLuhan's saying the collective disservices of these mass weapons of destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
The technologies for total destruction of mankind and the planet, and all the hydrogen bombs and that, intermissiles, what were they called? Interballistic missiles. Maybe that was the phrase. Whatever Kissinger and them were trying to control through the SALT agreements, the Cold War threatening technologies of 60s and 70s, they flipped into a service, a public benefit, a peace, and a peace that passes all technology. The peace being that we couldn't have war because we wipe ourselves out.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So the private vices of the military-industrial complex flipped into the public benefit of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Peace in quotes, because it's a peace for the, what, the maintenance of a global economy.
Mm-hmm.
You get nuclear war, there goes the chemical body and the global economy.
Right.
So it's only one kind of peace, peace for the chemical body. There is war in the 60s and 70s between the TV body and its landscape constituents and the coming chip body. So the Kissingers of the world manage peace only for the chemical body. And that is ineffectual and an incomplete situation because it's only a meme. It's only one quarter of the situation.
Yeah. Well, it's the platform. With no chemical body, then nuclear war happens. There's no chemical body, TV body, or chip body. So it's the foundation. You got to preserve that first. You have to preserve the animal body. Then you got to work on the war that's going on in the TV and the chip body.
Right, but if you're part of an elite, you can have a nuclear war as long as you escape in your rocket and start over again in another planet, which is what he was saying back in 1951.
Who said that?
McLuhan. Remember?
He thought that the elites had the technology to be able to do something like that?
Applied science, now the master usurer. To hell with our topsoil. To hell with people dying. We can grow potatoes on the moon tomorrow.
I didn't know we could take that literally. I thought he was being sarcastic.
No, he's showing their attitude. They're not worried about nature paying 5,000,000%. Another way nature pays is by being wiped out.
McLuhan believed that the elites had the technology to be able to survive a nuclear war, even to the extent of setting up shop on another planet?
Yeah. He knew that the Tetra managers were making plans and scenarios well ahead of what the public knew about. Because the Tetra manager knew how serious the situation was. I mean, you could have a nuclear war.
Yeah. I can imagine them building underground bunkers the size of cities that they could live in, but not leaving the planet and setting up shop on another planet. I don't think we have that technology.
No, but you're missing the Tetra managers think ahead generations.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That's what the average person doesn't understand. When you're appearing to run huge, massive environments and have done well for generations, you don't think locally. You think of preserving that. This is what Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth and the Fondi think. They think that they steward this planet into the next couple hundred years, and they think that way. And they have an understanding of the cycles of economies better than most economists. And so thinking ahead is what the Tetra managers do. And they prepare all kinds of scenarios and try to encourage all kinds of inventions to deal with anything that could upset the apple cart.
Contingency plans. But are they capable of thinking ahead, or are they like Orwell? They're just projecting content from the past into the future, and then the future changes and all their plans don't work because they really don't understand the new situation at all.
Well, that's what happens when new bodies are formed. They're trying to manage their chemical body dominance.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking of transporting chemical bodies to another planet.
Mm-hmm.
So their plans are interrupted, confused, distracted by the new bodies that came along.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And that's why McLuhan made fun of them.
Right.
Remember, he said, I'm going to needle the somnambulist, that's the average citizen, and distract the triggermen. The triggermen are the tetra managers.
Mm.
By saying there are other bodies, talking about new landscapes that are going to undermine their plans, and highlighting popular events like the counterculture and all that he wrote about in the 60s as being a potent threat to the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And making statements about how the decision makers have no clue about their contemporary environment.
Mm-hmm.
He's needling the, distracting the tetra managers.
Mm-hmm.
He's proposing that there are other bodies being made.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that he believes that.
But he did believe it. You believe it.
No, I never believe anything I say.
That doesn't help.
I posted this on the Paranoia Talk last week. You got to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I explained, I told Joan, I said, anything I say or do, I do not believe in. But I follow the laws of the game. And the game is different media, and you need to know how to talk in each context.
Mm-hmm.
But to believe something is puny, as far as I'm
concerned. We just proved there's a TV body because of the way the kid channeled the TV body when he was, you know, being revived. I mean, you believe in the TV body, don't you?
I don't believe in it. I watch the effects of the environment around me. I'm describing the environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, believe in it means identifying with it.
Right.
Because it could be stopped, turned off. Yeah. Turn off the TV environment. You're not going to have kids doing that. But mm-hmm. as long as we do have a TV body environment and a chip environment, the kid will do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the law of the situation. So, you know, you have to know what you mean by the word believe.
Mm-hmm.
What does that imply to believe in something?
Right.
I'm not, like we defined imagination, I'm not embedded in any technological situation or any of the senses that it would extend it.
Yeah. Remember, I guess when you believe in the thing, you sort of kill the thing that you believe in. You're no longer really observing it. You're now believing in it.
Conception. You become it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not becoming what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Not saying it isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be careful about beliefs,
right?
Or about how you describe it. So then the next quote from Cliched Archetype, also page 139, is:
with the coming of film and TV, representative government itself has been transformed into image making, a subculture of Madison Avenue PR. The American dream that has been scrapped is, of course, that of, quote, the open road, unquote, which is now merged with Jet City.
So with the coming of film and TV, representative government itself has been transformed into image making. Representative government of Washington is a subculture of Madison Avenue PR.
Yeah.
The American dream that has been scrapped is, of course, that of the open road, which is now merged with Jet City.
Yeah.
Now, you know that the guys around Nixon, the Watergate, the guys who went to jail, remember the
yeah.
guy with the crew cut?
Yeah.
Forget their names. You know, chief of staff and that.
Yeah.
Not Magruder, but there was a couple of names. Anyways, those guys, one of them came out of a major advertising agency.
Mm.
You know, people don't realize how much the advertising in the 60s, 70s, how much the advertising agencies were involved with power. Exactly. McLuhan was describing that Washington was now dealing with the TV landscape. It hadn't become the TV body yet, right? TV body is later when it's miniaturized and digitalized within the chip body. So the TV landscape, this huge environment, this new organ for the collectivity. When I say a TV body, that's for you. The landscape is when it's first an environment for everybody, and everybody's inside the environment. In that sense, you're on the sidelines. Your chemical body is marginalized in relation to the new landscape. But people are still trying to get a democratic image. image in the White House to counter what is perceived as the bad ratings of Bush. And they think of it in terms of representative government of democracy, industrial democracy. And it's nowhere near that. It's 40 years ago that disappeared.
Yeah.
You have it's advertising, advertising, advertising in an American context.
Yeah. Well, this raises a new question for me. Because McLuhan was saying what's really powerful is the forms of the media.
Yeah.
But now he's lending a sense of power and persuasion to the PR guy from Madison Avenue who's just creating content.
All right. Now, you come to the Playboy interview with McLuhan, done in 68, published in March 69, where he explains that what the battle is now, as under satellite conditions, there is the merger into what I call the seamless web or the Android meme. Well, McLuhan called it the seamless web. I call it the Android meme. When you have the gradual disappearance, which McLuhan later began to see, the merging of the media into the resonating node, then what is that node is both figure and ground. If you look at page 11 of Take Today, he says, man becomes both figure and ground under the new electrotechnical extension of the central nervous system. It was merging to the point where content or information or the word that makes the market was the new environment. The daily soundbite from the White House was the new environment. There were no more environments to make in terms of separate media landscapes. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So content becomes the new environment.
Mm.
And so he starts writing in the late 60s and early 70s about PR men or content management, because that was the new media in an imploded seamless web.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
The phrase was the word makes the market. So it's good you perceive that, because that is a change happening in a book put out in 1970.
So he flips and he gives it even a greater sense of persuasion than the form?
No, the form is the content. The form merges with the content when there's a seamless web.
Okay.
We have satellites, computers, TV, radio, and everything else based on a press conference from the White House.
Right.
You have the beginning of Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
The person, the AP, the old body, approximating First Nature, is beginning to control all the huge media landscapes because those media landscapes are imploding.
So would it be true to say the form is the content and the content is the form? Is that what happens?
That happens after the satellite. That is the Thompson Quadrant, 67 to 72. Rai has returned to essence from the cosmic awareness point of view. That's on the inner plane, wherever that is. And the external manifestation on this human-made zone of second nature is the post-satellite environment, 67 to 72, where the word makes the market. The soundbite makes the market.
Mm-hmm.
What the president decides, is the president going to have Kissinger as an advisor or Marshall McLuhan as an advisor?
Mm-hmm.
That, the whole economy depends on that.
Yeah.
So he picks Kissinger, and we go in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the choices he makes are not personal decisions. They're based on Well, Tetrad Managing's obsolete, so what's...
It's Pentad. It's where the seamless web or the Android meme or the user-friendly clone or voluntary ESP, the Rumpelstiltskin tendency for everybody, is happening.
Mm-hmm.
It is... What was your word? Can you state your question, some words from your question again?
Well, it becomes the form is the content is the form.
No, I think we did that. What did you say after that?
So he's no longer Tetrad managing. So from what point of view are decisions being made, and who's making the decisions?
When the seamless web happens, the Android meme has come alive. It is doing the Secret Council 10 of Tetrad management. And since it's a machine doing it, or a merged of organic and inorganic technologies, organic being electric, inorganic being earlier industrial, the merger of that leads to that consciousness, which I call the Android meme, acting out Tetrad management.
Yeah, but the president doesn't go and ask the Android meme, what should I say in my next press conference, or who should my press secretary be, or who should my defense minister be. He doesn't talk to the Android meme.
Yes, he does. You know how he does it?
How?
He has other people write the speeches. The speech writers consult with all the different departments, and all these different entities are media, representing huge environments. He has to get opinions from all the departments of state, housing,
yeah.
Pentagon. The consensus forming among all these media environments that the White House represents management of,
yeah.
That's all second nature. It's become an interactive process where he must present through the polls a proper relationship to an audience that can respond immediately in polls. It's like me talking to you. It's a direct reaction. That's as organic as machines are going to get. And that's a simulation of a bunch of people in a little room discussing things, interacting in a village or a tribe. It's become that small.
So whose self-interest is he seeking to protect or prop up? Because he's a chemical body, and he still has all the interests of the chemical body at stake, so he can't just be letting this soulless Android meme technology run the show. Somebody's interests are at stake here, and they're probably tied back to human beings in some way, shape, or form.
But human beings have become cyborgs by the 20th century. They've been cyborgs for a couple hundred years under print and mechanical conditions.
Yeah. Well, this is where we have to begin to look at the fact that when you talk about the four bodies, they're really all merged now.
Yeah, and it's an ecology. The interest he has in mind is keeping the media ecology in relative operation.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep people fed. You have to keep people entertained. You have to keep people